space by talking about our Court with Class program. Today we have students from Hamilton High School here. Would they please stand so we can meet them all? Well, good morning and thank you for coming. You may be seated. For those of you who don't know about our Court with Class program, this is a program that the court runs with the State Bar of Wisconsin. All the high schools of the state have been invited to send students to Madison. We supply materials about your case. These schools may have had attorneys in to discuss the case with the students. And they are here to listen to the oral arguments and learn, hopefully, as we are here to listen to the oral arguments. And at noon, they will be joined by Middleton High School, and they will meet with Justice Babbage, who will talk with them about the processes of the Supreme Court. So now that we have met the students, I would like to introduce to the court, some others here. So on my far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. Sitting next to him is Justice Wilcox. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinitz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. To his left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And on the far left, Justice David Prosser. Again, taking care of most of the housekeeping business, but I would like to tell you that I will be leaving in a few moments to attend a joint finance committee meeting, which is dealing with the state court's budget. So I will listen. I will be participating in this case. I will listen to the oral argument tapes at lunch, and I may be back within just a few moments. So I just want you to assure and reassure you. With that, we call our case 97-2869, Eberle versus the Dane County Board of Adjustment. Mr. Kastner will be representing the Eberles. Mr. Kastner.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, may it please the court. My name is John Kastner, and since April 1, I'm an attorney with the law firm of Brennan Style based in McDougal. This case comes to the court today on the trial court's dismissal of the Eberle's state and federal takings claims, the dismissal of their substantive and procedural due process claims, and the dismissal of their claim for attorney's fees and costs under the Civil Rights Act. All of those dismissals were sustained by the Court of Appeals. Our docketing statement incorrectly sets forth the standard review in this case, and I want to quote from the Zinn case because I believe that it accurately sets forth the standard of review applicable to this matter. The pleadings are to be liberally construed to do substantial justice between the parties, and the complaint should be dismissed as legally insufficient only if it appears to a certainty that no relief can be granted under any set of facts that the plaintiffs can prove in support of their allegations. Of course, that standard is appropriate because this is a case that was decided on a motion to dismiss. There's two issues that I want to talk about today, and one of them is going to relate back to the standard of review and the reason we're here today. But the first of those is the Real Enterprises case. We set out at the beginning of this case and have consistently argued throughout the history of this case for more than 4.5 years, or about 4.5 years, that the Real Enterprises case is bad law. And we have briefed that, and the court has received briefs from the two amici on that issue. And I believe the briefs do a good job of setting forth all the reasons why we believe that it's bad law. But I want to touch on a little bit what's wrong with the decision.
Mr. Kastner, before you go into that, I'm going to ask you, just would you go over the facts little bit, because I have a question on the two roads. One is Timberline and the other is Corey, and how the decision was made, if you recall, how there are two pieces of property and just how that was initially decided by the board, if you recall.
Yes, I do, Your Honor, Justice. Mr. Eberle petitioned for a zoning change. He had a 40-acre parcel and he wanted to create two lots. In order to create the two lots, he had to rezone the property. And as part of the process of obtaining the rezone, the town had indicated that it would be their preference if they rezoned the property, that access to the property be only from one road. This property was up in the corner of the township, and it was going to necessitate that ambulances and school buses take a long 6-mile detour in order to get to the two houses that would be created in this, on this 40-acre parcel. For that reason, for those policy reasons, the town board insisted and the county board agreed that access would be limited to the one road. That was imposed as a deed restriction as part of the zoning change, and it became the Dane County law that we couldn't access the property from Quarry Lane. We had to access it from Timber Lane. Now, what Real Enterprises says...
Sir, could I ask you one question?
Yes, Justice.
In this map of the property, we have Lot 2 and Lot 1. Who owns this property here?
There's a gentleman that owns that lot. I don't know the name.
It's not the Eberles.
It's not the Eberles, no. The Eberles do own some land to the south and the west of that, but they don't own...
How was it that this 42 acres had this tiny, thin, narrow piece out to Timber Lane out here?
Years earlier, the Eberles had owned that parcel of land. They sold that parcel of land to a third party.
This part?
Yes. And when they sold it, they preserved the access to Timber Lane.
How long did they own all of this land?
I don't know the answer. I would be speculating, but I do believe it was a number of years. Probably more than five.
And it was just agricultural land?
It had been agricultural land, and all of the land along Timber Lane was cut up into residential lots. Other owners. My client created the one residential lot on Timber Lane.
Was it actually farmed?
It had a long time previously been farmed, yes. What Real Enterprises does is unusual. The court took the standard set by this court first in Howell Plaza 2 and then restated in the Zinn versus State case, which was that regulatory taking could not occur unless there was a legally imposed restriction. In Howell Plaza, that had come up in that the Department of Transportation wanted to extend a highway, and they had announced their intention to do so, and the owner of the property went and talked to the zoning administrator, who told him that he wouldn't be able to develop his land, but that wasn't a formal action. He then filed a lawsuit arguing that they had taken his property, and this court, I believe, appropriately said, there's been no legally imposed restriction on you. We haven't taken your property yet. There can't be a taking until we actually do something to your land. He hadn't asked for a permit. He hadn't been denied a permit. Now, the legally imposed restriction rule was brought to the court in the Real Enterprises case, and the court added something to that restriction that had not been there before, and to the best of my knowledge, has never been done by another court. And that is, it said that a legally imposed restriction, which the adopting agency later repeals, rescinds, or amends, may be a compensable temporary taking. That's all good so far. It's the next part that's problematic. It says, but if a court reverses the agency's action which created the restriction, a legally imposed restriction does not exist, and no taking has occurred. So what the court has said is, if it's illegal, it's not a taking. And there's no logic in that argument. And it's there is no case law that supports that extension of the legally imposed restriction that I have been able to find, and I don't believe any has been cited by opposing counsel.
Maybe Judge Garski simply forgot to put the word in permanent.
Well, that's a possibility, Justice Babbage. But the first English case deals with temporary takings. And a temporary taking is, in the first English contemplation, a taking by a governmental agency that's subsequently rescinded by a court. The whole point of first English is that if an action is subsequently rescinded by a court, the taking occurs at the time the agency acts, not when the court rescinds. That was what Los Angeles County was arguing in first English, is that the taking doesn't occur until the court acts. And the court said, no, it goes back to the day that the action occurred. And no subsequent action by the government, and I contend, including the courts as an agency of the government, no subsequent action changes it from a taking into a merely reversible action.
Counsel, if we conclude that Real Enterprises was erroneously decided, at least as to that one sentence that you just quoted, that one sentence being of the circuit court versus the agency, there's no change. If we decide that it's that sentence was erroneous and your property was temporarily taken, do your due process arguments then fall by the wayside?
I don't believe so, Justice. Is it Justice Bradley or Walter
Bradley? Bradley.
I don't think they do. In this case, my client had sold his property to a third party, and he was forced to buy it back because he didn't get the permit. He was forced to pay more money to get the property back than he had sold it for. He had started building a house, which he had to eat. He wasn't able to obtain any compensation for the work that he had done before he bought the property back. I believe that those are due process damages that relate to the denial of property without due process.
Why wouldn't we, if the premise is taken as a given, that is, if Real Enterprises was erroneous in that respect, we say this is a temporary taking, why don't we just remand it for determination of damages? And then you can talk about the $20,000 that you suffered, and you can talk about any other damages you want to talk about, and handle it that way.
If it was a temporary taking, and I would be happy to have it remanded, since that's what I've asked for, if you remand it because it was a temporary taking, you will be remanding it for a trial to determine if there was a taking, and if a taking is found to have occurred, and certainly one has been alleged, then the question will be just compensation for the period of time that my client was deprived of the property. If the court also finds that my client has a right to a due process claim, it would be remanded for a determination as to whether or not due process has been violated, and I believe that given the certiorari decision, that should almost be a foregone conclusion. But if it's remanded on that basis, the remedy will not be just compensation, it will be damages.
I understand the difference of remedies. The Seventh Circuit cases are not, I'm not sure, but it seems to me that there can be argument that, look, if you exhaust your state remedies, then you don't have due process, then you don't have your due process claims preserved. Do it with your state remedies. Here's a state remedy of a taking, and you go that route, and you're taken care of.
That's a very scary argument.
It might be scary. Is that your understanding of what, let's say, the Gamble versus Eau Claire County case? That's one of the Seventh Circuit cases.
Let me address that. What the Court of Appeals said in this case, in reference to the due process argument, says, we glean from these cases, dealing with the Seventh Circuit case that you've just been talking about, we glean from these cases that a federal substantive due process claim arising from allegations of excessive or arbitrary action, with respect to limitations placed on the use of property, does not arise under 42 U.S.C. 1983, where state law remedies exist to seek reversal of the challenged action. In this case, as we have said, not only did such remedies exist, they were successfully pursued by the Everly. This is the part of the decision that I'm most troubled by. This is going to be my second argument. I'll deal with it now. What the Seventh Circuit has said is it doesn't make any difference how outrageously the Board of Adjustment or any other similar body behave. They can act arbitrarily. They can act capriciously. They can act excessively. They can act in their self-interest. They can act outside of the law. They can be totally lawless. There's a case before the Seventh Circuit right now, Forsyth versus Sussex, in which a town chair, as a part of a zoning approval, said, "We won't approve your zoning change unless you personally give me, the town chairman, 2 acres of land." That's the extent to which this law goes. We're here on a motion to dismiss. The issue is not, did they violate due process or not at this point? You're supposed to assume that they did because I said they did. The issue is, do we care that they violated due process? If you don't care, it's open season. If you're on one of these boards, you can do whatever you want.
I mean, is that the issue, do we care? I mean, how about the issue being, what does Gamble versus Eau Claire County say when it cites Williamson for the proposition that Williamson holds that even if a taking can be challenged as a denial of substantive due process, a suit based on this theory is premature and the plaintiff has other possible state remedies and you have to exhaust state remedies. So I'm not sure the question is, do I care? I think the question is, if the Seventh Circuit is correct,
first of all, I believe that this case is distinguishable from the entire line of Seventh Circuit cases cited below. And I believe that because all of those cases were dealing with zoning cases. This is not a zoning case. This case was before a quasi-judicial appointed body that had no legislative powers. The issue before the body was whether or not my client should get a permit to build a driveway. The driveway was a permitted use under the zoning. The house that he wanted to build was a permitted use under the zoning. The issue that this body was charged with resolving was, did he file an adequate erosion control plan? Now, the record is replete. And the trial court, in its second decision in November of 96, sets forth 3 pages of excerpts from the transcripts of the proceedings in which the Board of Adjustment said, this is a perfectly wonderful plan to deal with the construction of the driveway. We just don't think you should build it. But they didn't have power to make that decision. So the reason this case is distinguishable from the federal cases is, number one, this was a quasi-judicial proceeding. The Seventh Circuit cases make very clear, going back to the Coniston versus Hoffman Estates case, which is the first of the series of cases that were cited, all of those cases go back to Coniston, and Coniston says, this is a legislative matter. You don't have a lot of due process rights in a legislative proceeding. If this was a judicial matter, it would be a totally different matter. And none of the Seventh Circuit cases have ever gone back and said, well, we don't care about the judicial-legislative distinction. I believe this case can be separated out from all of the Seventh Circuit cases on that basis. But the Seventh Circuit is doing something that's important. They're taking care of their house. They're saying this is not supposed to be a federal matter. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said you have to deal with due process on the basis of who you're in front of. And the standard that you apply should be that you try to get in front of the body most appropriate to handle the due process issue. And they're saying this belongs in state court. They're not saying you don't have a due process remedy. They're just saying you should be getting your due process in state court, not here. Now, we went to state court. We did what the Seventh Circuit told us to do. And they dismissed all of those actions or did the things that they did largely on ripeness grounds. Well, my case is right.
Counsel, maybe I'm confused here. The issue before us is whether or not not whether or not we should overrule real enterprises, even though you've stated it that way. It seems to me that the issue is whether or not this was a taking in violation of your client's constitutional rights. And if it was, we are therefore going to have to overrule real. But it doesn't... aren't you putting... isn't this whole last 10 minutes putting the cart before the horse? Or don't I understand this?
Justice Babbage, I'm not sure that you do. My client filed the takings claim, a federal claim which was dismissed without prejudice on rightness grounds because we had a state takings remedy. The court subsequently decided that we didn't have a state takings remedy because Real says it isn't a taking if a court reverses. And a court reversed. So, by definition, you can't have a taking if you have to go to court to get it. It can be a taking if the agency voluntarily reverses itself, but if the agency is smart enough to know, Mr. Knight is certainly smart enough to know, that if he tells his client, you've done wrong, and they reverse themselves, that they're exposed to damages. By simply deciding, well, we're not going to reverse ourselves, take us to court, I can get them reversed, but I can no longer get a taking. Because Real says it ceases to be a taking if it takes a court to say they acted improperly, even if they know they were wrong when they refused to reverse themselves. And that's a horrible temptation to put before people who are charged with enforcing the rules. You mean I can do whatever I want and ignore the rules, and all I've got to do is say I just won't reverse taking the court?
But Justice Bradley's suggestion makes some sense, doesn't it? Because at least at the time that the county acted, if in fact they were acting consistent with Real, why should they be forced to pay damages? If we overrule Real, then from this point on, if they should do this, then of course there's a violation.
First,
you can get damages.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt the question. Justice Babbage, First English says that the taking occurs when the agency acts. When the agency acted in this case was the day they denied our motion to reconsider the denial of the permit. From that day on, my client lost the use of his property. That extended for 3 years and 9 months. He had no legal means to get on his property. If he tried to use Quarry Lane, he'd be violating county law. He would have been subject to criminal forfeitures. The only way he had to get on his property was from Timber Lane, and the Board of Adjustment told him he couldn't have a driveway. So they took his property. It's a clear case of a regulatory taking. And going to court didn't make it or not make it a taking. It only decided that they had, in fact, acted arbitrarily in denying the permit. Now,
Mr. Kastner, if we were to hold that a taking occurs when the administrative agency completes its action, what then? What else do you want?
If the court holds that a taking has occurred, I believe it would be appropriate to remand the case to the trial court for a trial. You won't rule that a taking has occurred. You'll rule whether or not Real Enterprises says a taking can't have occurred. If you overrule Real, then Real does not preclude us from having a trial on the question of whether a taking occurred or not.
Mr. Kastner, maybe you can clear up for me something. let's assume that there was a temporary taking. Don't you still have a ripeness problem here? Don't you still have a question related to a final decision and the matter being ripe for adjudication?
I don't believe I do, Justice Crooks. Williamson says that ripeness is resolved by a final action by the agency taking the action. The Board of Adjustment was not a legislative body. It did not have the power to zone my client's property. It attempted to rezone my client's property, but it didn't have the power to do that. There was nothing further the Board of Adjustment could do. We asked for a permit for a driveway. It said, we don't think you should have a driveway. It supposedly had the power to approve or disapprove or request changes in the design for the construction of the driveway, it chose to ignore the design of the driveway. It chose instead to say, you shouldn't have a driveway. It didn't have that power. There was nothing further I could get from that body. To suggest that I could get a variance was immaterial. A variance would have said, you have the right to have a driveway, or you don't have the right to have a driveway, but I already had the right to have a driveway. The only question is, how do I construct it?
Was the Court of Appeals basically saying that because you could go to the trial court and have that decision overturned, that the matter was not ripe for determination?
The Court of Appeals said it's not ripe because the Seventh Circuit cases said that it's not ripe, that you have this certiorari remedy. I don't believe that certiorari satisfies the requirements of due process. First of all, as I've indicated, this was a quasi-judicial proceeding, and the Seventh Circuit has made very clear that the rule it was applying was applicable only in legislative cases. So I believe that any reliance by the circuit, by the Court of Appeals, on the Seventh Circuit decisions was misplaced. And I don't believe that ripeness is an issue, and I do not believe that certiorari satisfies due process requirements.
You say you don't believe ripeness is an issue. Seems to me that it is an issue. Maybe you think the answer is a slam dunk, but it is an issue to be addressed. You don't think it's even an issue to be addressed? It's raised in the Court of Appeals, you know, it's argued, it's briefed, da-da-da-da.
Justice Bradley, I would concede that this court and every court that has addressed this matter has a duty to consider whether or not this case was right. I believe that the history of this case the law as applied in this case leads to no other conclusion but that this case is right.
When I approach a case, I kind of look at, first issue, second issue, third issue, what do you have to answer as a precondition to the next one? Is ripeness the first issue we have to address before we get to any other issue, or doesn't it matter? I mean, it seems it's kind of intertwined with the taking. Is ripeness the threshold issue we address?
I believe that Williamson puts it very high on the priority of things that the courts need to address. As I've indicated, I believe this case is right. But it is something that would always have to be considered on a takings case. Williamson makes it that way. Counsel yesterday sent a fax filed with the court, stating, indicating that he wanted to address the question of the Paternalist Foundation versus City of Plattsburgh. While that case has been recommended for publication, I don't know that it's actually been published, and I don't know whether or not it's appropriate to make reference to a case that has not yet been published. My time is up.
You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Attorney Knight.
Please, the court. My name is Ravi Knight, the Deputy Corporation Counsel with the Dane County Corporation Counsel's Office. Here with me today is Christy Gollum, who's an Assistant Corporation Counsel with the same office. We represent the respondents. Respondent's position that the threshold issue in this case is also the ultimate issue in this case, and that is ripeness. The United States Supreme Court tells us that the starting point in any analysis of a regulatory takings case such as this one is the question of whether Williamson County and the ripeness test adopted in Williamson County has been satisfied. Ripeness test adopted in Williamson and its progeny presents an initial hurdle to the successful statement of a regulatory takings case such as this one. The hurdle requires that the plaintiff landowner has received a final decision regarding the application of the regulation in question to the land in question. That initial hurdle recognizes that the Fifth Amendment does not prohibit the uncompensated regulation of land per se. Rather, the Fifth Amendment prohibits the uncompensated land, which, in the words of Oliver Wendell Holmes, goes too far. Of course, a regulation which goes too far and triggers the Fifth Amendment requirement of just compensation is a regulation that deprives the property of all economically beneficial use. The Williamson rightness doctrine, the threshold issue in this case, recognizes that a court cannot determine whether there has been a compensable taking until there has been a final decision with respect to the application of the regulations to the land. At the heart, the Williamson rightness test is the determination that an agency's initial decision is not a final decision if there is available state law that provides a procedure where that initial determination may be altered, thus altering the application of the regulation to the land in question. Williamson holds that a regulatory takings claim cannot state a right takings claim if it has failed, the plaintiff has failed to pursue at least one of the available state law procedures for obtaining a final decision. Importantly, under Williamson, there are two distinct results which flow from having obtained a final decision. First, having obtained an unfavorable final decision, the landowner may then state a right takings claim and proceed to attempt to prove that it is in fact a taking because it has deprived him or her of all beneficial use of the property. On the other hand, this is important, if the landowner obtains a favorable final decision, that is, if the final decision, it's not the initial decision, the final decision, lifts the restriction or approves the use that was requested by the landowner, then a taking never becomes right. No takings claim can be stated, and in effect, a takings claim is extinguished. Thus, under Williamson, the interval between an initial unfavorable land use decision and a final decision under available state procedure cannot be the basis for a takings claim.
Well, counsel, that may be the law, but it strikes me as being quite an unfair law. If I'm the owner of 80 acres up in Portage County, and the state, for whatever reason, takes a very valuable chunk of that and denies me the use of that for 3 years, and then I go to court and pursue my remedies, and I finally get that overturned after 3 years. And meanwhile, maybe I have been offered, somebody's offered to buy the land, and then withdrew that offer after the taking, so I've suffered economic damages. I've suffered damages as a result of not being able to use the land. I haven't been able to go turkey hunting or fishing or whatever on the land. I haven't allowed my family to use it. It seems to me that those are pretty substantial damages, and yet you're saying, no, you get nothing. Because in the final analysis, you got your land back, albeit you got it back 3 years later. That seems to me to be the argument you're making.
That is the argument, or that is the basis of Williamson County. Yes, it is, and it's progeny. I think my point would be...
Does that strike you as fair?
Yes, it does. Because the assumption behind your question or statement is that your property has been taken. But Williamson County tells us...
I'm not drawing a legal conclusion. I'm saying just in terms of myself, I have lost the use of that property for a very substantial part of my lifetime that I can never get back.
It depends on what you want to develop on the property. Let's put it in the context of this case.
I just want to use it. And I've been denied the use.
If you have been denied, by a final decision, all economic use of your property,
that's
you have a takings, and at that point it is a right taking.
But no, that's not my case. My case is they took it away from me for 3 years, but finally after 3 years, I was able to reverse it. So, but I have been denied the use of that property for 3 years.
Let's put that in the context of this case. These plaintiffs, these appellants, were denied the opportunity to construct a particular driveway in a particular location in a particular manner. 3,000 feet of fill, 4 feet deep, 20 feet wide, cutting through a wetland.
Let me just ask you to interrupt. How would they have gotten there for getting the wetland? Was there another access to this property? That's why I asked the question of the opposing counsel on the facts. I understood that the board said you could only go from Timberlane. There was no other access to get, so the property was, you couldn't get them. Maybe there was some other one.
That is correct. Under the pleadings.
Well, what's correct? They couldn't get to the property?
Under the pleadings, which is all that we have before us, the fact that there was a limited access requirement placed upon the property when the appellants requested the rezone is true. The appellants had one means to access the property.
One way to get to it. That's right.
Approximately 60-foot strip of land. Unfortunately, on that strip, there was a small wetland. What the appellants did, which is the point of Williamson, which I'll get to, is they provided a single plan for development and said, this is how I prefer to do it. This is the structure I want to put on there. This is how I want to get to my land, this particular driveway. I want to cut across this wetland. I want to dam this wetland. I want to do it so there is no bridging over the wetland. There is bridging over this little stream here. No bridging under the wetland.
Was there any other way to get to this land is my question.
My answer is, we don't know. It hasn't been pled that there was no other way to get to the land. The fact that there was no other way to do it is not before us. It hasn't been pled, and that's all that is before us.
Counsel, you make that argument on page 8 of your brief, but it seems to me that what we have is a court of appeals and a trial court that says, look, you acted arbitrarily, that the plan submitted by the Everleys under the ordinance should have been approved. And it wasn't approved only because of your arbitrary conduct. That's at least what the Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court found in their decision. My question is, if this plan was okay under the ordinance, but rejected for arbitrary reasons, if the Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court found that it should have been approved under the ordinance, why should they be faulted for failing to allege that there may be an alternate plan?
Because arbitrary conduct, improper conduct under state law, is not part of the takings claim. That's the answer. Question.
Well, maybe it's part of, and I don't know this, I mean, I'm just exploring, maybe it's part of a due process claim. I'm looking at that Gamble case, and it says, there is also, this is also true, the very end of the Gamble case, the second to the last paragraph, that is also true under still another theory, that an interference with private property, which did go so far as to be a taking, might still be a deprivation of property within the meaning of the due process clause entitling the landowner to relief if the interference has been arbitrary. And it cites a case that I've not read, I versus Sarasota County. But let me get back. I mean, it seems to me you're saying in page 8 of your brief, look, they didn't allege that there should have been another plan, so they should be faulted for that. And it seems to me a bit difficult to fault them for failing to allege in their petition of complaint that there is another plan when both the Court of Appeals and the trial court found, as a matter of law, that the plan should be approved under the ordinance but for your arbitrary conduct.
And that decision by the Court of Appeals, as it was a decision by the Circuit Court that was affirmed by the Court of Appeals, vindicates the state law right that you are referring to.
If the Court of Appeals and the trial court found that you should have approved the plan. Why should plaintiffs allege that there may be other plans?
Because the question under the Fifth Amendment is, has the landowner been deprived of all beneficial use of the land? The question is not, was the landowner under state law entitled to access to the property in the manner that he preferred? That is a state law matter, and that has been fully vindicated under Section 59.594 here. That is the relief that's provided for that type of claim. Under the Seventh Circuit's reasoning in Gamble and in River Park and in Gosnell, which are cited in my brief, as the Seventh Circuit said specifically in River Park, the opportunity to challenge the land use regulation through certiorari is, I quote, assuredly enough to satisfy the requirements of the due process clause, and that is the rationale of the Circuit Court in this case, as well as the rationale of, in this case at least, of the Court of Appeals. Now, as I indicated in a letter that was provided to the court yesterday, subsequent to this case...
Before you address that, address the threshold issue of whether or not you can discuss that case since it's not a published opinion.
My thought is I'm not going to discuss that case. There is an alternative to the Seventh Circuit's line of cases which say if a state law provides a certiorari action, that is assuredly enough to satisfy due process. There's another line of cases out there. Actually, it's not a line of cases, it's the Sixth Circuit cases, in particular the Pearson case, which I don't have a cite for, cited in the Internalist case. The Sixth Circuit adopted a shocks the conscience test for determining whether or not a due process claim can be stated in the context of a land use case. And that's a context of a land use case. That's not a context in the context of a zoning case or an administrative permit case. That's in the context of a land use case, which is what we have here, and which is what we would have here if it's going back to zoning at the same time. In the Pearson case, the Sixth Circuit adopted a shocks to conscience test as the appropriate standard for determining whether the allegations stated a claim of constitutional dimension, as opposed to stating a claim simply, maybe that's the wrong word, of state dimension.
Now, when you talk about...
No, go ahead. I was going to say that in just picking up on this, so we won't read the Eternalist case, or won't refer to it until we understand whether or not it's going to be published, but shocking the conscience and not being able to answer or say the answer to the question, if one cannot use their land for 3 years and 9 months, might shock someone's conscience, whether it's Justice Pavlich's 80 up in the Court of Equality or some other place. It just seems to me that, as Justice Bradley has referred frequently to page 8, that what you're saying is that it was for the landowner to come up with suitable alternatives to present to the Board of Adjustment how they might have used this land, when the reality was is that this was a created situation created by the Board of Adjustment, that you can come in from Timber Lane, and it was explained that because of ambulance and emergency vehicles. And the question I have is still whether or not there was any access. When we say no use, just the way I'm envisioning coming into this property, at least for 3 years and 9 months, is by some winged vehicle that you have to fly in to get there. Is that wrong?
As counsel for the accounts told us, this land had been used for agricultural use for years prior to this.
Well,
and there had never been a driveway on this portion of the land.
Isn't that because they came in, excuse me for interrupting, that they came in from this other way? are you saying they could still come in from Timber Lane? All I want to know is how they would get there.
My answer to the question is yes. And I guess my real answer to the question is that it's not alleged that they cannot. And the only facts before this court are what's in the pleadings.
Yes.
However, as we've heard, it was the land has been used for agricultural purposes historically. There is no indication whatsoever in the pleadings that it cannot now be used for historical purpose that it was put to, that is, for agricultural purposes.
Okay, so your answer is that they could take a tractor, drive across Timber Lane, and then get on the property. That's all
That is my answer.
Okay.
And once again, that's my answer.
Can you grow crops on residential property?
Pardon me?
Can you use residential property for agricultural purposes?
I think that the real question here goes back to how we got into this mess to begin with. Appellants wanted to develop their property. They didn't want to sell one lot. There's no profit there. They wanted to sell two lots. They went to they asked for a division of the land and a rezone. The town said, you're going to cause us all kinds of trouble, so you can just access one way. And the appellants looked at it as a business deal. Assuredly, can they pass on the cost of this requirement to the buyer of the land? And they said, we will accept that condition. It's not a condition that was on there before. It's not a condition that was placed on the land naturally. It was a condition that the appellants agreed to in order to make a profit on their land. Now, they're coming to us and saying, gosh, this restriction that was placed on their land so we could subdivide it isn't going to work, and you are stuck with it, county, although we agreed with it. So, the answer to your question is, the real answer to the question is, once again, the pleadings do not provide an answer to that question. There is no allegation that this land can no longer be used for its historical purpose of agricultural use, which means there is no allegation, essentially, in the pleadings, that the appellants have been deprived of all economically beneficial use of the land.
How do you distinguish this case from the Zinn case? If I recall correctly, the Zinn case is very much like this case, but for the fact that the agency rescinded its ruling. Am I correct with that?
That sounds correct to me.
If that is correct, then you're left with this as a rule of law, which seems problematic. And I'm tying in the real case now. Under Zinn, if there's a taking, and an agency rescinds its ruling, I mean, then there's a taking. But if the board lets the court do its dirty work, and let the court rescind or vacate its determination, then the real case stands for the proposition that only mandamus will lie and there can be no damages. Is that your understanding of the real case?
No, it's not. I think real has got to be read in the context of the Williamson case. Williamson is the rightness case. Williamson is the granddaddy of them all that tells us how one can state a right taking.
What should we do then with that language at 677 of the real case, which states, but if a court reverses the agency's action, which created the restriction, a legally imposed restriction does not exist and no taking has occurred. That's stated without citation, I know. What should we do with that phrase?
What we should do with that phrase is put it in the context of Williamson. Williamson tells us that if you have a non-final initial decision, that is, as Williamson held, let's back up. Williamson was a case of a denial of plat approval by the Planning Commission. What the Williamson court said was that denial of plat approval isn't a denial of all beneficial use of the land because there's a variance procedure out there for you to alter that decision. So although it's not, it denied you temporarily, if you will, the use of the land, there's always a procedure available under variances to alter that decision. Thus, the decision isn't final until the variance procedure has been pursued and no variances have been allowed. At that point, at that point only, is there a final decision as to how the regulation is going to be applied to the land. The question isn't how a particular agency will apply it in the regulation if there is another way out, so to speak, under state law. You have to carry, under Williamson, you have to carry it to finality, which is, well, in the context of this case, putting it in the context of real case, again, there were three ways out in the direct Williamson sense of the final decision requirement. That is to avoid the restrictions placed on the land by the Board of Adjustment. In this case, the appellants could have gone and asked for variance under Chapter 59 of the statutes. That way they could have avoided the restriction placed on the property, and they could have put their driveway in as they wished. Or they could have asked for a rezone. They could have had their land rezoned as a means of avoiding the restrictions placed on the land.
But then they couldn't use, rezone back to agricultural use, is that what you're saying, or what?
Well, they could have asked for a rezone to any district, or to, it doesn't matter. Yes, they could have asked for a rezone back to agricultural. They could have asked for a rezone out of the shoreland district, and there is, in fact, a provision as to how that can be done, as cited in my brief. Also, and importantly here, Dane County Ordinance provides a means in which they could have had the access restriction placed on their property as a condition of rezone lifted. In other words, they could have gone before, and this is important, before the county board and asked to have that restriction lifted. And then they could have accessed the property from Quarry Lane as opposed to being forced to access it from Timber Lane. The point there is there were alternatives to just giving up and saying, I can't use my land. That's what Williamson says. If there are alternatives available under state law, those alternatives, at least one of those alternatives, must be pursued to its final fruition. What happens under real is, besides the variance possibilities, rezone possibilities, and in particular the reapplication under a modified plan, which we haven't mentioned here, but is mentioned in Williamson, to those three options is added the option of pursue your judicial rights and have the court modify the Board of Adjustment's determination, and in this case, as it did happen, have the court enter directly into the Board of Adjustment's decision-making process and order that the special exception permit be issued.
Are you advocating that as one of your alternatives, the real approach?
Yes, I think that real property is, in fact, a logical and consistent extension of Williamson.
Well, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems rather circuitous that in order to have a final determination, you have to exhaust your state remedies, which means appeal to the circuit court or ask for cert to the circuit court. But then you say Williamson indicates that there is not an exhaustion of remedy. It just seems that you're going in a circle when you say that appealing to the circuit court is one of the available state remedies, because under real appealing to the circuit court then takes away any chance of them getting any damages. Right?
Wrong.
Oh, I thought the only thing they got was mandamus under real.
The assumption that we're all making is appeal to the circuit court overturns the action of the Board of Adjustment as it did here. In other words, the final decision, which is the point of Williamson, in fact gave the landowner what the landowner wanted, thereby extinguishing any takings claim. The alternative to that is, in fact, that the Circuit Court upheld the denial of the special exception permit. At that point, we have a final decision under state law as to how the regulation will in fact be applied to the land. And at that point, the appellants can state a right takings claim and proceed to try to prove, and it would be a tremendous hurdle in this case, to prove that denial of that permit, in fact, deprived them of all economically benefiting.
I thought final decision meant final decision by the, you know, the regulatory agency. If you're defining final decision as a decision rendered by the circuit court, I can tell you that's not final. And what about the Court of Appeals?
Under the
what about us? You know, I mean, where do you, if that's the way you define final decision, and then wait till we issue an opinion, and then give us 30 days for a motion for reconsideration, and then it's right for you to start.
Under taking jurisdiction, the state law procedures which are available to obtain a final decision are listed in the disjunctive. Reapply under a modified plan, or apply for a reason, or apply for variance, or if you put real into this mix, or apply, request the certiorari, request certiorari relief. It is in the disjunctive. Pick one, pursue it to its finality, and you have a final decision. But then, of course, the question arises, well, why are we here? Was it a final decision yet? My answer is that listing in the disjunctive is always in the singular, too. No one, for instance, in Williamson, Williamson points out there's two means of getting a final decision. Go before the planning commission, the initial decision maker, and get variances under the law of that state. The law of that state also indicated that variances could be obtained from the Board of Zoning Appeals. Either of those two means were means of obtaining the finality within the meaning of Williamson. You did not have to pursue both. I think under that reasoning, Williamson and that line of cases would not require that a landowner go before two different judicial bodies to acquire finality. I think that decision of the circuit court would have been considered final decision under the Williamson line of cases.
Irrespective of the question of finality, could there ever be a takings in this case, given your theory that it could have been zoned back to agricultural land?
The takings would occur if the rezone back to agricultural land was denied in conjunction with the denial of access to the land. Right? So the theory there would be there's no residential use, there's no agricultural use, there must not be any productive use of the property. But that's the case. And there are no available state law procedures which would alter that decision, in other words, grant or make it a non-final decision. Then at that point, you would have a taking.
But if it was rezoned, if they had requested it to be rezoned agricultural and that had been granted, then there was just no taking ever.
That's right. The takings clause does not grant a landowner the right to use the land as preferred. It rather prohibits the takings of land for public use without compensation, and it's clear that that means takings, that is, means depriving the landowner of all economically beneficial use of the land, and that economic benefit may be agricultural as well as residential. The law doesn't distinguish where the benefit comes from. It may just as well come from residential use or agricultural use or some other use.
Are there any other questions? Court?
If I may, just one quick one. So, as I understand it, the due process, the 14th Amendment, is trumped by the state law that sets forth the procedures. And if you follow the procedures that are set forth in the statute, then you can't exercise 14th Amendment due process.
If I may take just a moment to answer that in two ways.
The first answer is,
your understanding is right. Under the Seventh Circuit line of cases, Gosnell, River Park, and gamble, and I think you're also right under the, well, not entirely right, under the Sixth Circuit's line of cases, which adopts a shock to conscience test. More importantly than that, I think, though, is we're talking about a property right protected by due process. And the question then is, did the appellants have a property right in the granting of that permit? And first of all, just realize we're running out of time, but referring to Williamson County, Williamson County itself notices, specifically states that the rightness test adopted in that case applies whether or not the right being protected is the respondent's expectation in a permit, or whether or not it's the Fifth Amendment right to not be deprived of property without just compensation. And just to finish up, this court's decision in Hummel Oil and Refining versus Wanner, WAHNER, in 25 Wisconsin, indicates that a property right can only be obtained if there is a, if the use being requested is flatly permitted. And in that case, the Hummel Oil case, this court held that if approval of that use is subject to a regulatory agency, that is not flatly permitted. That is not a ministerial action. That is discretionary. And in that case, you do not have a due process right, a property right, protected by the due process clause of the Constitution.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Cassidy?
Thank you, Justice Tigers. Counsel is basing his argument on Williamson County. Find the rightness argument that it sets forth. In reading from page 186 of Williamson County, the Supreme Court states, as the court has made clear in several recent decisions, the claim that the application of government regulations affects the taking of a property interest is not right until the government entity charged with implementing the regulations has reached a final decision regarding the application of the regulations to the property at issue. In this instance, the government entity is the Board of Adjustment, and it had reached a final decision regarding the application of the requirement that we get a special exception permit. There was no further proceeding that could be had before the Board of Adjustment, and there was no administrative appeal proposed or available by statute or ordinance. This was it. What we had to do if we didn't get this permit is we had to go to court.
Counsel, would you specifically address your opponent's response that you should have asked for a variance, you should have asked for a rezoning?
A variance would be a request in the zoning that would allow us to do what we could already do. We could already access